Elgin Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals. Hello and welcome back to our investment commentary podcast. I'm Mark Chappell. What does it mean that a city is up and coming? Is it an influx of young, recent students, a business park offering new office jobs? Maybe it's more trains that run on time. Elgin Real Assets, our property team based here in London, have developed a way of looking at local areas in the UK which are best placed for employment growth. This is a key driver of property growth, and crucially, for those of you who might be thinking about adding a property fund to your portfolio, employment growth, which is strongly linked with property returns. Joining me this week to discuss their framework for local success is Bill Page, Business Space Research Manager, and Robin Martin, Research Director. Bill, Robin, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Hi, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
So to take it all the way back to basics, Robin, where do commercial property returns come from?
So there's two broad components of return. There's capital growth. So for people who are thinking about their homes, clearly they've seen an appreciation in house prices over the long term. We see some of the same things happening in commercial property. So there's a capital growth dynamic. But then something that's really important to a lot of investors is income return. So this is the income that they receive from their investments on while they own them. And in a world where interest rates have got very low indeed, that's a real motivating factor for a lot of investors.
Tell us a little bit more about income return.
So income return is really driven by the supply and demand for commercial property space. That's ultimately what we're offering occupiers. And what we're always trying to do is identify assets that meet the needs of occupiers. I mean, it sounds like a really simple thing, but in practice, it's a little bit more complicated. But what that does is then create demand for the asset, which then creates an income stream that we can then return back to our investors. And in particular, one of the things that we're seeing is that there's a lot of change in terms of the economy and demand for space that means that those income returns are becoming, to a certain degree, more volatile and there's disruption going on. And so finding ways of creating predictable demand for our assets is becoming really important. And the more stability we can add to that demand, the more stability we can add to our income streams.
So stability in the sense that we're finding good quality occupiers for these property spaces that we're renting out, as it were. Is that oversimplified, Bill?
Not necessarily. And ultimately, income return has driven about two-thirds of total returns for commercial property over the last 30 years.
So total returns for owners of a property fund, for instance.
It's the money an investor would receive in totality. So a combination of the income return plus the capital growth Rob mentioned. So about two-thirds of that has been driven by income return, which has traditionally been the more stable part of total return, less volatility when you compare it to capital value movements. Predicting income return is really, in our view, more around employment growth. So the more the employment grows in a particular area, the more bums on seats there are in office buildings, the more money people have to go and spend in local shops, and the more demand there is for manufactured goods, which may or may not be produced in that local area. So if you understand employment growth, we have a good way of predicting income return going forward.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, this is not just about looking for good quality companies to occupy the space. It's about looking at the kind of holistic way of looking at an area of where are the jobs of the future going to be and can we add more in order to create more demand for space?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right, because we're seeing a ton of change in the economy. There are certain sectors that are becoming larger, employing more people. Mm-hmm. Conversely, there are other sectors which are declining. And if you've got a location which is particularly well-equipped to take advantage of that growth, then that really implies that they're going to have more employment growth. There's going to be more demand for space. And actually, as investors, that's a pretty good place to buy. On the flip side of that, if you've got locations which are fundamentally challenged and are very exposed to sectors which are contracting, that's quite a difficult place to be. It doesn't mean that you wouldn't ever invest there, but it certainly means that there is a probably a higher bar that we need to clear to kind of make sense of that as an investment.
So it's almost a portfolio construction tool, if you imagine it in that way, of kind of, is it, it's a way of asking the right questions of an area.
That's correct, Mark, and that's really well put, actually. We couldn't have done that better ourselves. So the way we think about this piece of work and our application of it is not top-down, we're telling what our fund managers are to buy. Mm-hmm. We are guiding them in their decisions to tilt towards some of the strongest areas that we predict from our research will outperform. As Rob mentioned, the great thing about real estate investment is that every asset is different. Every asset has its own story and fundamentals. So we would never seek to prevent deals happening in areas that might be perceived as weaker. The fundamentals of that individual real estate asset might be compelling. But in general, we expect that portfolios tilted to the stronger areas in our research will outperform over the long term.
So tell us a little bit more about this framework that you've developed. What are the high-level kind of drivers of this employment growth that you're looking for?
Okay. In terms of what drives employment, we've taken a step back and looked at some of the academia, as well as our own experience. And there's a world of research out there on this subject. I mean, you can quite easily do a master's degree in it, which we haven't. So we've only managed to keep the high level observations. But what drives employment is effectively output, so the amount of wealth a local area creates. And there's a good piece of work done by Ron Martin, no relation of Rob Martin, who's sitting next to me. He's a Cambridge University professor of urban geography, and he's found that output growth explains about 90% of the difference in employment growth at the local area. So that's useful. So we know economic growth drives employment growth.
So the simplest thing is more people creating more things or creating more output, and therefore the likelihood is there are going to be more need for more jobs in that area.
Yes, correct. But what explains output growth is the next phase in the research. So what explains output is productivity. Not necessarily the numbers of people, but how productive they are in terms of producing what it is they produce, be it the manufacture of goods or a service sector, value-add economy. And what explains productivity, there are various other studies done on this, and we can draw on the work of Paul Krugman, who's another well-known economist, and he lists various factors such as amenities, so whether an area is pleasant, there's something for its workers to see, do, entertain themselves with, and the business environment, so how entrepreneurial an area is, transport links, but also educational institutions. And Krugman lists an educational institution as being very important, and there are other pieces of work that go beyond that.
So this would be a college, a university, that sort of institution?
That's right. So there's two parts to this. There's the creation of knowledge through universities, mm-hmm. schools, and increasingly, you know, other kinds of research facility. And then it's the skills that the population in that area then have. So that's why it becomes really important to be able to attract talent, mm-hmm. bluntly, but also retain talent. And this is a really interesting topic, because there are certain cities which have very successful universities producing a ton of really, really well-skilled and highly educated graduates, and those graduates then move away. So as a way of kind of improving their fortunes, there's a big opportunity for those kinds of cities to then work harder on retaining their talent so that they then go on to create a lot of activity.
It's so interesting you mentioned that, because I've often thought of various kind of towns, and maybe this is a pure stereotype off the top of my head, of university towns where it seems like the town is made up solely of the students who attend that university. And of course, there are some university towns which have thriving jobs, like research centres around it. I'm thinking maybe of Cambridge, for instance, there. But then there are certain towns who are empty during the summer holidays, for instance. So if I'm getting what you're saying right, is that the differences between these two types of cities are enormous, because one is keeping all of that knowledge that has come here to learn, but then they're letting their students go away in that sense. They're not creating the opportunities to keep those students.
Yeah, correct. And we use the word leakage for that, to explain those towns and cities which don't retain their students. And again, there's a lot of work in academia on this kind of driver. And Edward Glaser, who's a Harvard professor, mm-hmm. does a lot of work on what drives city success. And if I can put words in his mouth, he would say education is the key, and maybe education. And he would be critical of vanity infrastructure projects, so large scale, high profile investment into some infrastructure projects which may not be justified by in the local area, as opposed to spending on education. And the key thing for us is to understand how those local areas can retain that talent, because ultimately it's that talent retention that can draw in more inward investment in terms of corporate occupational demand.
So, Bill, is education to be considered, I mean, from your description of Glazer's research, that it seems like when it comes to local spending, you spend it on education first if you've got nothing else to do, because that's the key. How important are other factors that come into play with education?
So there are many things to consider alongside education. So I mentioned the presence of the higher education institution itself. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, Mark, that creates its own clustering effect. Particularly knowledge-intensive clusters tend to locate around universities. And the education of the residents, if you can retain those students in the local area, that really pays dividends in terms of attracting companies in, because ultimately a company wants to invest in an area that will fulfil its needs for future mm-hmm. growth and future growth of talent. But also, there are many other factors at work in determining a city's success. Business vibrancy is one. So by that we mean entrepreneurship. The creation of new businesses tends to correlate quite well with subsequent employment growth. We have looked into business diversity, and the jury's still out on the driver of business diversity, because in certain economic cycles, it would be beneficial to be specialised to a particular industry. And I'm thinking maybe high tech during the dot-com boom of the early 2000s. But in other circumstances, it would be more beneficial to be more diverse and to protect yourself against some downturns, which might be sector specific. So over the long term, that kind of evens itself out.
So I'd love to unpack this business vibrancy, where you mentioned about kind of the environment to create more businesses in a local area. And I guess, how much can a local area sustain, like more business after business? Do some businesses need to be allowed to fail? I mean, entrepreneurship, what does that mean in this context?
It means that businesses should be allowed to fail. And obviously that's unfortunate to experience if you're working for those businesses. But experience and research tells us that the churn of businesses is a better explainer of employment growth than business growth per se. So you do need that sense of entrepreneurship and businesses being allowed to fail. It also has implications to the local political economy.
Okay.
So where local government can encourage that growth, whereas it could be the provision of cheaper office space, for instance, mm-hmm. for startups to go grow, maybe fail, maybe merge, but employ more local talent, that's key.
Getting a bit more involved in the kind of venture capital-esque role of that.
There is a really interesting example here that's been researched in quite a bit of detail, which is comparing Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Okay.
And there was a really detailed piece of work done a few years ago now, which looked at the two cities in around 1970. And at that point in time, there were lots of things about those two cities which were very similar. They had similar level of skills. They're both mm-hmm. concentrated on tech. On paper, they looked pretty similar from an economic perspective. But what's actually happened is that San Francisco has just accelerated in terms of growth relative to LA. And one of the big reasons we think for that is that the business environment was totally different. LA was dominated by a small number of very large, well-established companies operating in the defense industries. San Francisco had a very different culture, which was much more freewheeling, mm-hmm. a little bit more connected with the universities, was much more willing to take risks. And that, I think, is like a microcosm of a much broader thing that we see. Harder to pin down in terms of numbers, actually, but really important for when you think about growth potential.
Of course. I think it's a case that you know it when you see it, is that when you have these local areas where quite often it's not pandering, but it's catering to the needs of these kind of large employers, but very almost monopolistic on the jobs that are in that area. But how much are you giving that consistent employer in incentives who may not be growing the number of jobs or future employment demand versus how much you're supporting smaller but more vibrant businesses in the future?
When larger businesses tend to grow more slowly than smaller businesses, which sounds like an obvious point, but larger businesses are increasingly waking up to this fact and trying to co-locate with some smaller businesses or seeing the value of having perhaps co-working facilities nearby or even in one floor of their building to foster that entrepreneurial culture, which they can then capitalise.
Shared working space type ventures.
Yeah, and Canary Wharf is a good example of that. So we're talking partly away from the local area fundamentals, but it's still a very strong example. So they set up their incubator space within one of their buildings, and this is obviously a high-profile financial services-dominated estate in London. And the thinking there was very sound. So if you provide the right environment for small businesses to grow, you can then capture that business as they expand and mature. And maybe the growth profile of their employment might slow as they expand, but it's being in the right place at the right time to capture that initial rapid growth.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, I imagine then it's about being around the right kind of people for this. If you're going to have business diversity, as you're explaining, you need to have the kind of infrastructure of, as you say, in Canary Wharf, you're being surrounded by financial services professionals. So brand new fintech startups, to take an example off the top of my head, probably would do very well in that environment where you are in constant contact and you can not poach people, but you can attract people to your brand new businesses and therefore generate that kind of growth. Is that right?
That's right. And people, I mean, it's a terrible word, but people talk about agglomeration. But what's behind it is right, which is the idea that if you get a lot of bright people together in a relatively small area, ideas will pass between them and new innovations will take place that wouldn't have happened if they were just meeting each other over the internet. And there's actually quite a wealth of data now that actually supports that idea. Mm. And particularly when you think about, transposing innovations in different sectors. So, a biochemist next to an IT software developer, there's probably something that will happen if you put leading thinkers in their field next to each other, but they won't necessarily meet each other otherwise. And there's definitely and this is particularly where universities can become really interesting, the ways that they can promote knowledge exchange. But more broadly than that, and again, it's areas like Shoreditch in London. You've now got these kind of hubs developing of people doing broadly similar things, but not directly competitive. And you get a lot of sort of innovation and value add through that.
I guess there's a case for attracting talent from everywhere to your location. So it's making sure that people are quite mobile. I mean, you've mentioned in the piece about mobile labour versus immobile labour. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
There's a nuanced view on population growth. So population growth per se would correspond well to employment growth, and that's as you would expect. It's pretty obvious, and it's a circular driver. But one of the reasons we see population growth as being important is because mobile population tends to be better qualified, so more talented. People with qualifications, training, degrees tend to move around a little more than people without.
Because they're willing to move towards these better paying jobs?
And the jobs are willing to attract them in as well. So there is a view that growing cities will tend to grow even more strongly because their talent base will improve over time as they grow relative to a baseline. For cities and towns where the population is static or falling, that would tend to embed decline because less well-qualified people tend to remain in the same area, and that makes it more difficult for inward business investment.
Is that what I've seen referenced as the brain drain? Is that equivalent of that, would you say?
That's right, and there's quite a lot of work that's been done that shows that then your ownership of housing can become actually more of a millstone around people's necks. So if people who are less well-qualified, bought their house, but ultimately they're on lower incomes, and so moving does not have the same kind of financial benefits to them as it would to other people. But their biggest asset is in this city. It's often a tie, and that creates a certain amount of sort of inherent sort of sclerosis in the process, and that is a real challenge for some people.
Interesting. So I imagine there's a big element of if there is this kind of you own this house in this area. Transport must play a major role in all of this. And I think you mentioned it earlier, is making sure who can move. If you are in a house, where can you commute to? What counts as a commutable distance? I mean, you've got around London, you have quite literally the green belt of commuter towns, as they were. I mean, it was Metroland a couple of years ago. What role does infrastructure have, transport infrastructure, sorry, have in this kind of framework of yours?
Oh, it has a key role, not as key as education, and just to repeat the earlier point.
Would this have second billing?
I think it would. I think it would. Now, the reason transport infrastructure is so important, again, you've got a combination of economic theory and real-life practice. So if you take a big step back, what transport enables two locations to do is specialise in something and trade with each other.
Okay.
Otherwise, if there was no transport, they'd have to do everything themselves and do it inefficiently. So it drives productivity, again, going back to our economic fundamental. There's a property implication as well, because the more well-connected an area is in terms of its transport, the more dense it can build its buildings, and the more likely you are to get those knowledge agglomerations that Rob mentioned as well. So buildings can be higher, they can be closer together, you can get more people into the same physical area. And we've looked at this and tried to measure it, and we found that areas that which have better transport, so more people coming to work in that area by a train, a tube or a tram, tend to have employment growth that is stronger than average over the next 10 years. So there is a forward indicator there.
Interesting. What's the catalyst behind that? Is it because people can come from further away? Is it track-based transport, which is a difficult phrase to say, better suited for commuting and ultimately employment growth?
Well, I mean, you know, what do we call it? It's mass transport. Mm. So you can move a lot of people into a small area very quickly.
Okay.
And like the UK's already had quite dense cities, more from history than anything else. If you look, if you look over at the States, often the pattern of urban development is very spread out and low density. But that's partly because a lot of cities have grown up in the era of the car.
I mean, that goes back to your LA point, which is dominated by a sprawl of freeways rather than public transport networks.
Correct. So trains, other kind of track-based transport, are particularly good at moving a lot of people around. One of the things we'll also see, you know, we've got more congestion charging going on now. I think there are both policy and environmental considerations that are making car transport more of a question mark. And then on the pull side, you know, one of the things that we're seeing very strongly amongst younger people is a desire to be working in towns and cities. Historically, business parks, so out-of-town offices were very popular with a whole range of businesses, and they absolutely still have their role, but we are definitely seeing a drift for people wanting to be in towns where there's other things going on than just, you know, really valuing that convenience of being able to just park the car.
Exactly. So this goes back to your earlier point about amenities, well, a broader trend of urbanization, but you want to, you know, go work in a town where you can walk out the door and go to a coffee shop for lunch and maybe go out to the cinema at night if that's straight after the office. Is that a misreading of it?
Not at all. That's very fair. Ultimately, people want to live and work in an area that's pleasant to live and work in.
Of course.
And that's a human desire that is completely understandable. Mm. Finding a metric to measure that is more challenging.
Yeah.
To take it back to our research, and we've played around with a few things. We've looked at the proportion of green space, which is a good indicator of how nice an area is relative to an average. We've looked at the proportion of businesses that are leisure orientated, so gyms, pubs, bars, restaurants, that kind of thing, which matters to people and matters to workers. We've even looked at the difference between house prices and local income. The thinking being, if there's a big difference that can't be explained, that might have something to do with how pleasant an environment that is to live in.
Exactly.
People are prepared to pay a little more for their housing.
So even though people's income or on the whole around that area may not be, is disconnected from the house prices because those houses are in a place that people ultimately want to come and live and work in.
Exactly, yeah.
But to take it back to your point about Rob, about the way people are changing, the demographic shifts of the world, there's been a lot of talk about the rise of flexible working. I mean, we talked about it there from the WeWork of like not even having a dedicated office space, for instance. What does the rise of home working and flexible working implications have on the office space of the future?
Well, I think when it comes to office space, there's quite a few things going on here. We have seen a lot more focus on zoning offices to be functional to different parts of people's jobs. So, you know, we all have our heads down, need to be at the computer quietly time. But particularly in sort of knowledge services, there's more and more emphasis on getting people working together constructively. And that needs different kind of spaces. You need more breakout spaces. You need more sort of almost coffee shop style things. And you know, WeWork is the most obvious barometer of
course,
this.
Yeah.
But it's by no means only about that. And I think it does respond to a genuine desire for many companies to create a different kind of environment to allow their employees to have different kinds of interactions. And again, it then comes back, I think, to, you know, what kinds of locations does this happen in? Well, broadly, the more busy and bustling a location, the more that is going to work.
Yeah.
And I think you might well see people choosing to work from home when actually they want to do their quiet work, but actually when they need to interact and they need to be stimulated by things going on around them, I think it's very hard to do that at home, really. You're almost certainly going to want to be in a bustling location to do that.
I imagine that's quite often there. People are doing, absolutely, as you say, they're quiet, like reflective knowledge, building that knowledge at home, but then coming into these urban network areas to share that knowledge. And it is a kind of a build and share kind of model. Is that broadly the future trends that you're seeing, Bill?
Oh, it's definitely a trend we're seeing now and have been seeing for some time.
Okay.
As Rob mentioned, there is a desire from workers, but also their employers for more flexible work. It's a more pleasant way to organise your week. It enables you to work in an area that's most appropriate for the task in hand. But fundamentally, it does not diminish the importance of the office, and particularly not a headquarters office, because you still need an area to come to collaborate or host clients, do presentations, all that kind of good stuff. What's really changing is where the actual work happens.
Yeah.
And home working is becoming a bit of a misnomer, because people can work coffee shops on the train as long as the IT enables them to, but we are seeing an increasingly flexible mindset, and there are some implications. So the headcount growth that we see and we expect does not necessarily translate one to one in terms of that city's working day population.
Well, exactly. I mean, it used to be that if you hire one as a company, you hire one person, you have to have a desk for that one person. Now, with the rise of hot desking and flexible working, you know, you can often be at 120% capacity for your workers versus the desks, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. And there are some cost pressures that force that. So employers are feeling the pressure from increased accommodation costs and increased wages, and they have to try and make their accommodation work, and that can mean squeezing more people into the same amount of space. Indeed, that's what has happened over the last 10 or 15 years, and so there are some implications to city growth. And in terms of infrastructure, we've already seen the likes of TfL undercut their expectations for passenger numbers, and there are some funding implications to that. So not as many people as they were expecting are using the tube. The reasons behind that are still to be determined, but flexible working could have a lot to do with that.
It's interesting because there's still employment growth in London, and yet the number of people commuting into London is going down. So the question is, where are they going? The answer is probably a little bit flexible working.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a conundrum that you need to build into this framework that you've built. To move on to another area of your piece that you talked about future trends, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the rise of autonomous vehicles and what that means for office space demand, because particularly where you absolutely, as you said, business parks used to be so popular because you could just drive your car, park it there, leave it there for the office work day, drive it back home. With autonomous vehicles, there's a sense of disposability. You can get in the car that arrives to pick you up to work, drops you off the office, and then it leaves. What are the implications of autonomous vehicles down the line?
The first thing to say about autonomous vehicles is that it's not too early to start talking about autonomous vehicles. I think many people might hear this piece and say, oh, that's 2030 plus, I'll switch off. But in real estate terms especially, that's not too soon. So, you know, we're a long-term investor, as are many of our competitors. And if we are holding an asset for 10 years, then that starts to become an issue towards the end of that whole period.
I mean, essentially, that's only two property purchases away,
if
you think about it.
Exactly. And it's an old adage that you always need to think about what your next purchaser can do with the property you want to sell. And autonomous vehicles will be an implication. And if you're designing a big piece of infrastructure or a big piece of real estate today, like a shopping centre, you know, these things take 5 or 6 years from first plans to delivery, and it's not too soon. That's a digression to say that we are thinking about it now, and it's important that we are thinking about it. But the implications for city life, I think it's an increased sense of flexibility. You mentioned it, Mark, in that people can call an autonomous vehicle on their smartphone. It's not theirs. They can get in it, perhaps do a bit of work on their way to the office, use the office as that collaboration zone, and then leave the office to go home or go somewhere else, but also do a bit more work within the autonomous vehicle. Yeah. So if it does reach this potential in terms of being an area that you can work while travelling and work far more effectively than you can at the moment on the train with your smartphone, etc., it'll underscore this trend for flexibility, and people will start thinking about the office and the reasons they are coming into a city differently. And it will also change potentially the nature of urban pricing.
Okay.
So I stress potentially, because these things need a lot more thinking about, but almost everything we know about urban pricing, particularly in the UK, rests on proximity to public transport. So the more well-connected a micro area is, the more people would want to work or live in that micro area, and the higher the pricing is, whether that's capital values or
house prices next to underground stations.
Exactly. And we see that implication. We've seen it with Crossrail. We've seen it with the Jubilee Line extension, etc. Mm-hmm. So this is what we know about urban pricing. If you change the link between public transport and pricing because people are using public transport differently, then things get quite exciting, because you can see a change in those pricing gradients across cities. Probably less so in London, because the vast majority of people use public transport to get to work in London, and it's going to take something really massive to change. The rest of the UK, there's still a lot of people who drive to work, 70-80%. And if you change the way they get to work and what constitutes a good location because of how accessible it could be for an AEV, there is potential for something different to emerge in 2030 plus.
Interesting. So, I think we've covered a lot of the longer term trends. Robin, if I could turn to you for our final topic, something a little bit more immediate I imagine it's quite a difficult topic to really kind of pin down in any meaningful way. And that's the subject of immigration, because it's such a key driver of jobs demand for employment, services, of course. Talk to us a little bit more how this fits into the framework that you guys have built.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about talent, and you know, that is very much bound up with this topic. You know, one of the things that we have found is that a city that, you know, attracts talent during the day, so where people are in commuting relative to out commuting, that's generally a driver of performance. That's, you know, very obvious, I think, in many ways. But what we have also seen is that much more generally, a mobile population is an artifact of a high growth city. And a lot of people would say, you know, a lot of people come, for instance, to London or Edinburgh or Cambridge when they may be in their 20s and 30s. But once, you know, once they get a little bit older and need more space, they might move to a different kind of location. So population mobility per se is something that we find to be quite positive. Undoubtedly, the conversations that we've been having over the last couple of years about how the system might change have led us to ponder, to be honest. And we don't have, you know, clearly we don't have a huge amount of clarity over the detail of how the system might work in the future. But the principles now seem to be that the policymakers will be quite thoughtful about identifying where the country needs skills and ensuring that the system for encouraging people to come to the UK will reflect our need for skills. And that is a really important principle from our perspective and a useful one. Quite how it plays out, we don't know, obviously. But the acceptance of that in principle, we take to be positive.
Is this where a policy like, think just a few years ago, something like the Northern Powerhouse, is that the kind of idea that we're talking about here, is really supporting jobs growth in these very specified areas?
So a big part, I would say, of the whole Northern Powerhouse idea was saying that there is potential in a number of the major northern cities that is not being unlocked yet.
Yeah.
And part of it is about the fact that because transport infrastructure links across them are not that good, they don't get the benefit of all of these network effects that we've talked about. And transport could be one part of addressing that. It cannot be the only part.
No. So
it needs to be, you know, we talked about vibrancy and about an entrepreneurial culture and all of those things need to be there as well. And policy can help with some of those things. But certainly it was about taking some great ingredients and allowing them to sort of be unlocked for greater growth in a more powerful way.
To wrap this up, I feel like this framework incorporates a lot of very distinct, very interlocking ideas from transport, particularly education, business vibrancy, and as you said, taking into account a lot of the new trends that are coming down the line. How, in the final summation, how would you say this framework really helps structure your investment ideas, Bill?
Well, we use it in our investment decision making. As I said at the start, we are not top down. We don't determine which locations our fund managers should acquire in, but we do, we hope, influence their decisions. So when a property, for instance, is being taken to our investment committee for a potential purchase, we will see what implication it has on that fund's portfolio by geography. So would it be accretive to future performance because of where it is, or perhaps would it be detrimental? If it's detrimental, can we challenge it by saying, OK, what is it about this asset itself, which is a strong story because we're not confident that you'll get growth from the local area? So we've used the word tilt before, which we think is an elegant enough way to describe our approach. So portfolios which are tilted to the stronger locations in our study are expected to outperform. And you know, we're pleased to say many of our funds, in fact, all the balanced funds we do measure, do have an overweight position to the stronger areas relative to benchmark. And that is something we want to maintain and want to grow.
Look, that I don't have a great deal to add. Maybe the only thing I would say is that this whole sphere of thinking around backing local economies has become more and more important the longer our commitment to particular assets is becoming. And purchase costs are so high, you know, capital growth is low. We're really making, you know, 10-year decisions here. And this kind of thinking is so integral to how assets will perform over that long horizon that we attach a lot of importance to it.
Thank you so much to both of you for joining me for such an interesting discussion and an interesting topic. Thank you very much to you, Bill. Thank you, Robin. To read more about Robin and Bill's research, we've published their article on our website called Investing in Future Cities, also linked to in our show notes. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks to our wonderful production team. See you next week. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.